testified at the proper time?
Well, testified at the proper time, of course, comes from the scripture. We generally translate to be testified in due time. If you see Rotherham or others will say testified at the proper time. This isn't the theme scripture, and again you say, okay, that's sort of a weird thing. What are you connecting that with the whole appearance of Jesus for? This particular scripture quoted in Matthew 2:6 is the one I wanted to use because it talks about the fact that, you know, Bethlehem was the birthplace of Jesus, and said, you know, from there would be one that would go forth to be a ruler in Israel. Of course, Bethlehem in the past and Bethlehem in the present are quite a different place for those of you that have ever been there. And I actually was going to title it, Why'd You Choose Such a Backward Time in Such a Strange Land? If you'd have come today, you could have reached the whole nation. But I'm not sure how many of you would have gotten this. Anyone know where this is from? That statement? See, that's why I didn't use it. Now, not Godspell, you're close, though. Jesus Christ Superstar. One of the contentions was, you know, why did you come when you did? Because, you know, you could have, if you'd come in the days of mass communication, everything would have been great. So that's why I didn't use that title. But the whole point of it is, you know, today we're fighting a lot of people that are trying to search for the historical Jesus and find out who he was and trying to interpret in today's terms. But unfortunately, we can't. You know, the Roman Empire at the time Jesus appears and has this conflict is 700 years old. It's still growing, but to some degree it included most of the world that Jesus knew at that time. And at the time that Jesus is having trouble with the priests and the Pharisees, you know, Jerusalem and that whole area has been a protectorate of the Roman Empire for some 93 years. And it touched his life in many ways that we can't understand. But yet, remember, there was no mass communication. It was really strictly the area in which they live. And it's important to understand the context in which Jesus was raised and why he came when he did. The Judean province of the first century, you know, the Roman Empire hugged the rim of the Mediterranean and included many of the people, a lot of different colors of people. The banners of Rome appeared throughout the empire, along the Danube, along the Rhine, along North Africa, Portugal, Syria, Belgium, Egypt, all part of that Roman Empire. Tiberias, at the time Jesus has his conflict with those prior to his death, was the emperor, was 70 years old at the time. You know, Tiberius was an interesting character. He suffered from acne, and he was very shy about that. But he loved to study. His mother, Livia, had really been the one that pushed him up the political ladder. And she was really prone that he would someday be as far as he could go in the Roman Empire, which, of course, was the emperor. Once he reached the emperor, never saw his mother again. He was a strong man. He was very dedicated to that empire, but he was totally unemotional. Enough that the colleagues called him the mask. He never showed his emotion. He believed in astrology, but yet he ignored pretty much all the gods of Rome at the time. His reign really was according to the Constitution. At least it started out that way, under the law, but then he turned all the matters mainly over to the Senate at the time. The decrees that he passed many times, or that the Senate passed, were against his wishes, yet he did very little to prevent them from happening. Tiberius wanted the Rome of the old days, the flurry of the Roman Empire, in which all the politicians enjoyed a kind of a nice life. I guess even our country would sort of like that now, but it was a day when things were as exposed as they are today amongst the politicians. And he wanted peace. He wanted peace along the frontiers of this wide-scoping element of Rome, of the Roman Empire. He came to the throne at 56 years of age, and with little knowledge of economics, in 14 years he developed a significant improvement in the Roman economy. When his reign began, there were 100 million sesterces, which was Roman coin at the time, in the treasury. When he left, 14 years later, there were a little more than that, 2.7 billion sesterces. So he's very significant economically and did a lot to help Rome move along. But yet he had this rigid observance of the Roman laws and the rights of others. And that was perhaps in some ways a downfall that made him much more autocratic as his life went on. There was this dual aspect of his reign. He started out being very constitutional according to the rights of Rome, but then he ended up with more and more power being concentrated into fewer and fewer hands. So that Caesar eventually became almost the absolute ruler in Rome and abroad throughout the empire. And we can understand why such passion was there at the time of Jesus. More power had been passed in Tiberius's reign into fewer and fewer hands. Around the 7th to the 9th year of his reign, he posted a huge garrison outside the walls of Rome, signaling to the citizens that it was a new way of life for them. Now, away from Rome, when he got outside of Rome, his reign was efficient, and he kept assorted officials throughout the empire in constant worry about what he was going to do. He used spies. He used his friends that would be informers. And if he caught anyone oppressing the subjects or going against his wishes, it would end in very unpleasant consequences. So you see the fear that existed in someone like Pilate if the emperor thought that he was disloyal. When he appointed Pontius Pilate over this land of the Judean province, part of the Judean province, this small outpost of Palestine, and as procurator, it was on the endorsement not of him, but of Pilate's wife and one of his informants, Sejanus. He would remove him for the least little infraction. Well, that's a lot of history. But, you know, historical context is important when we interpret Scripture. Whenever we interpret anything and we look, you know, disputes are part of this long-running conflicts. And long conflicts have cycles of intensity. We see that in the Middle East today, in our day. Strong emotions that are built up over time. An intensity that's very difficult for some to understand. No matter how benevolent Rome was, the Jews were unhappy. They were unhappy because they were suppressed. The most important festival to them was Passover. It was a time when they celebrated their freedom from Egypt. And they learned a lot from the Romans. They learned a lot in engineering. They learned how to build roads. They learned how to build drainage ditches, the aqueducts, all the things that they learned from Rome. But yet they hated Rome for one reason. They hated Rome because they were suppressed by them. They were taxed by the Romans heavily. There were taxes, small taxes. You know, we think about taxes today. And, you know, I have a county where I live, pass a 1% earned income tax. Boy, is that annoying. It's like 1%. Now the school district wants to do the same thing. 1% doesn't sound like a lot, but add up all these 1%, and it's like someone said, you know, 100 million there, 100 million there, pretty soon you got some real money. Well, that's what the Romans did. They had taxes on deed transfers. They had sales tax on food that was purchased. They had taxes on profits, as we do today. They had taxes on the exports and the imports. They had a personal sales tax of 1%. They had a death tax. And they had from time to time a tax that would be passed to help pay for trouble, suppressing the problems in further provinces. Remember at the beginning when Jesus was where Jesus was born, it says the world decree went out from Caesar Augustus, who preceded Tiberius, that the world should be taxed. I think it really was one of the special taxes, since we don't find a record of it, to help suppress problems that were going on in other parts of the empire. Well, it was something worse than that, though. Did the Romans collect the taxes themselves? No, we know they didn't. The worst thing, that they leased the right to collect that tax to the Jews. Now, that fee could go as high as 10% of what they were willing to give someone to collect the taxes. So you can see that it was those who were tax collectors, as was the case of Matthew, became very unpopular in the land. Well, when we have awareness of these kinds of issues that arose in those days, we can aid our understanding. And just as you see the feuds that are portrayed up here, going from the Capulets and the Montagues in the days of Romeo and Juliet, if you're a fan, Aaron Burr, and remember who he shot, which president was? Anyone recall Aaron Burr? Right, Hamilton. And then we had, of course, the Hatfields and the McCoys, the famous one, in case you're wondering. And, of course, J. Edgar Hoover was known to be pursuing Martin Luther King. Understanding the historical context of the feuds and disputes that took place in Jesus' day is an important part of understanding why people reacted the way they did. Well, with that background, I'd like to take a look at Israel at the first advent of Christ. And we're going to look at several different aspects of this. First, the land, the temple, the nations, the leaders, the city, and finally Messiah. And we'll go rather quickly through these, but I hope to give you the flavor of the setting that was there. And hopefully, as the first start of this day, it helps us understand in the studies we'll go through and everything else with our pre-memorial studies, understand what was going on in those days and being able to interpret it in the context. So let's look first at the land. Well, 21 years prior to Jesus' birth, Augustus had split the Roman area of Palestine. Sorry, I got to get some light here. Let me move this over here. Augustus had split this Roman provinces and secured them by the Roman domination through proconsuls. And this frontier area was administered by the emperor, but it was done through either appointments, that would be the area of Palestine, which is a procurator, or an appointment made that would to someone that would have a favor with the people. So the areas that were divided, interestingly enough, when we can look at this area and we think about it in terms of when Jesus was born. When Jesus was born, the territory of the ancient Israel wasn't unified, remember. It was very divided at that time. There were several groups that were holding politically different religious and political loyalties. They weren't separated from each other, however, geographically. So it's interesting because they all had to sort of pile in there. And the first group was a group of Gentiles and Hellenized Jews who incorporated this area called the Decapolis. These Jews had come in after the conquest of Alexander the Great. They were Greek Gentile soldiers. There were businessmen there. And they settled in this area with their families, and there were many Jews that also settled here and adopted many of the ways of the Gentiles. And that was a difficulty because this district of Decapolis had a cluster of cities that were sort of Western-like, and their beliefs in many cases and their language was essentially, they were essentially Gentiles. But yet for much of the time, they lived at the edge of this Jewish area, and they challenged the traditions of Jewish life. Remember in Mark 5 when Jesus had the incident with the swine? Well, that happened in this area of Decapolis. Of course, we know the swine were not popular in Israel, were forbidden, so that's where you found the swine was in this area, and of course the Gadarenes were in that area as well. The kingdom of Herod and his successors represented another element. Now, he had accommodated the imperial power of Rome, and Herod rose to power, remember, somewhere around 37 B.C., and ruled until his death in 2 B.C. And he was building projects, remember, all over. He was building at Caesarea. He was building at Sebastia to please Caesar Augustus at that time. And he built the project of the temple, however, to try to please his subjects. Because remember what I said before, that Rome really wanted those who were put in power to please the subjects as well as to create the peace. At his death, however, the kingdom was divided with Augustus' permission among his sister Salome and among those that were emerging and remaining sons, the ones that Herod didn't kill. Remember, someone said that it was safer to be Herod's pig than Herod's son because he killed all of his sons. Herod Antipas was given this region that you see identified here, the regions of Galilee and really in the eastern Jordan Valley. That's the Herod who, remember, had John beheaded, if we read in Mark 6, 17 to 29. And also, he had an interest in Jesus, and we find, remember, he was very anxious. In Luke 13, 31, we read about his interest in Jesus. Herod's son Philip, on the other hand, was granted this area, kind of region northeast of the Sea of Galilee that you see here. Herod's son Archelaus was given the rule of the area around Samaria and Judea. And, of course, Herod's sister Salome took the towns along the southern coast that you see here and near Jericho, but Caesar was not happy with her rule. So this is what he turned over to Archelaus later, and Archelaus was a very weak ruler, as we read about. So eventually he took that in 6 A.D., he took away that and put the Roman procurator there, a little earlier than that, he put the Roman procurator there, and eventually that was the fragment and the condition that he gave, eventually was turned over to the particular area of Pontius Pilate. Well, this was kind of the fragmented condition that you see of the land at the time of Jesus. So you'll see it wasn't a political unity. It wasn't even a geographical unity. But yet this was still the Holy Land. This was still the land to which Jesus was administering. It was the land that was promised to Abraham in Genesis. Devout Jews sought fervently to know how God was going to restore all this to them because it had been fragmented so greatly. You can understand why when they looked for the Messiah to bring this back, it was very important to them to see a unity once again in their land. Now Galilee, the area, of course, that Jesus grew up and moved around, was one of the more religiously conservative areas. And it was one of the areas that did have the proper observance of the Torah. But to get you a feel for how big the land was, it was 75 miles wide, 150 miles long, and had about 3 million people, which is roughly equivalent of a Chicago, Illinois at the time. And since we're in California, we have 150 miles from Fresno to San Francisco. So think about that as the length of Israel at the time. And roughly 90 miles if you go from Fresno up to Yosemite. That's about 90 miles, a little bit farther than what you have across. So that's really the land where you had this concentration. And the issue that the people had, because it was small, yet so divided. Really, if we look at what drove the lifestyle there, the climate drove the lifestyle for many of the people. If you think about Jerusalem, it was seldom over 88 degrees in Jerusalem. But yet in Jericho, just a small ways away, it was often over 120 degrees. So you can see when it's over 120, we hit 100 in Phoenix yesterday. And I know it drives you inside and dictates your lifestyle. And that's really what happened with a lot of the people here. That climate kind of drove their lifestyle. And it's important to remember that as you think about why people acted the way they did, where Jesus met some of the people. 25 inches of rain fell between November and April. Very important for them because, remember, they didn't have a well in their backyard, but the replenishment and the rain was a very important time for them to be able to produce the bounty that they produced. So the wells, when the wells were full, became gathering places for the people. And the work days with that climate were driven from 6 a.m. to noon, followed by work days from 3 to 6, generally coinciding with the sun. The temple. Well, the temple in first century Jerusalem, it's very difficult sometimes to know exactly what it looked like, but I like this reconstruction of Herod's temple that we see here. It's one of the best that I've seen. This is sort of what it looked like and where it sat in first century Jerusalem. And of course, the Temple Mount was a very important place where the people would gather. On that Temple Mount, which is what Herod was reconstructing during his years, started somewhere around 20 BC. He wanted this huge temple with the big courtyard. And he built a retaining walls that were over 150 feet high on the outside of this. And he flattened the top of the mountain in order to do that. So when you go today and see where that Temple Mount was, it wasn't always like that. But he trained the priests then, remember, as stonemasons. He wanted only the priests working on it. And John 2:20 tells us that in Jesus' day, that was still under construction. The two areas of the temple were the sanctuary, which you see here, the temple proper, and the courtyard. And the court of the women, you see, had this large receptacle for offerings. Remember the lesson that Jesus taught of the widow's mite, the one that put in a penny? And he said she put in everything she had. This happened in this court of the women because there they had this huge receptacle where people could offer. And Jesus spent his time teaching there. It was 15 steps up to this Nicanor gate. And the worshipers there would go and hand their sacrifices over the top of the wall to the priests. So it became a very focal point for all their work. The temple itself, the temple proper, was wooden. But yet it had this polished limestone, polished gold, polished silver that you see. And Herod was very particular in how he set those things along. The temple was the center of focus in Jerusalem. The Jews and Gentiles were separated by the wall. Remember Ephesians 2:14, Paul talks about that wall no longer separating us. That wall was a physical wall that prevented the Gentiles from coming in. And you can see it here in this outside court of the Gentiles. But yet Jesus taught in many of the porticos that you see around this temple area. And the temple hierarchy was controlled by the Jewish life around two laws, the Sabbath and circumcision. Those are two very important things in the temple. One other thing. There were many, many times when you had issues arising in the temple over certain things like Sabbath day or even taxation. Remember when Jesus cleared the temple because on the day of sacrifice, they would often charge 50 times for a pigeon what they charged during the regular times of sacrifice. When Jesus turned over all those things in the courtyard, it was because he was upset with how they really challenged what we would call usury today in charging the people for the sacrifices. The nation. The nation at the time had been composed of about, remember when they came back from Babylon, there were about 42,000 that returned from Babylon to build the temple. In the 4th century BC, the priests began kind of this rule that was a combination of civil and religious rule. And Herod appears some 35 years probably before Jesus in the story we have. And yet he controlled a great part of what went on that impacted eventually Jesus' life. Herod was appointed by Rome. Remember, he professed Judaism, but yet he married the high priest's daughter so that he could curry favor. He was married 10 times. And he killed most of his family. He renovated the temple for 7 years while he was around with 10,000 workmen. Herod Antipas, who was his son, and we still have him in Jesus' day, was appointed by Tiberius Caesar because he was a snitch. Remember what I said, that Tiberius was very anxious to know what was going on, and he appointed Herod Antipas because he could be sure that he would report back to him the things that were going on. Pilate was appointed governor of Judea by Caesar when the failing came from Salome and the others in that particular area. He succeeded Valerius, who was, again, a very weak person, and he was succeeded much later by others who would take a different view of things in Jerusalem. But Pilate and Antipas were at great odds. There had been an aqueduct connecting the pools of Solomon that were from Bethlehem to Jerusalem, and Pilate took money out of the Passover treasury. And that had never gone well with the Jews, and so they were always at odds over that. And when they stormed the Antonio Fortress to try to protest that, there were many that were killed as a result of that. And Herod became upset because they were from Galilee, his particular tetrarchy. So there was never good feelings between Herod Antipas and Pontius Pilate because of the incident where Pilate robbed the treasury to pay for the aquifers that ran into the area. The leaders. Well, the leaders were interesting. The Sanhedrin, remember, at the time sat in the court of the Gentiles. And they were pretty much the rulers that were agreed to be able to rule in that day. The word comes from a word meaning assembly. And they met at this southwest edge, you see here, of the inner court, from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. almost every day. There were three classes of membership in the Sanhedrin at the time. There was the priestly families, who were the Sadducees. Remember, at the time, Annas, who had been high priest, and Caiaphas were both of that nature. You had the ancients, who were kind of the laymen, who had great respect and sat with the Sanhedrin. You had the scribes, which were the doctors of the law. They were mostly Pharisees, who had also a great acclamation to the burdens of the people. The Sanhedrin ruled that temple worship in ways that we can't understand today. They had 7,000 priests at the time of Jesus that were ministering in that temple. They had their own temple guards. Their rulings were very important. In the criminal cases, they could rule to death, but it had to be sanctioned by the governor. They tried during the day and sentenced at night or the next day. There was no testimony that was given by the accused unless they were willing to endure questions. They had great political power in Jesus' day, as we're attested to in the Gospels. But they wanted this leadership against Herod and Rome. They still longed for this freedom. There was no prisons, remember, or there was no asylums in those days. Death was a normal sentence that took place for those accused of crime. And each sentence would be sanctioned by the procurator. Death by stoning, death by burning, decapitation, or strangulation. If it were reversed, the Sanhedrins were powerless to do anything more. If it was confirmed, then it was usual for the prisoner to be killed in the Roman fashion of crucifixion, which is, of course, what happened to Jesus. The city itself was an important part of the context of the Gospels. The city had about 100,000 that lived in it at any one time, although it swelled greatly during times of Passover. 150,000 a day entered the temple to worship. The west side, as you can see here, was really kind of the rich people, and the southeast corner really housed the poor. There were seven markets that were open on Monday and Thursday. Now, I don't know why it was Monday and Thursday. Who knows? We used to have, where I used to live, we had a market that all the stores were closed on Thursday afternoon. I could never figure out why the stores were closed on Thursday afternoon. Well, it used to be the old thing where the doctors played golf, remember, on Thursdays. I finally found out after 10 years living in this town that there used to be a stockyard auction in the late 1800s that would come through and was done on Thursday afternoon. So the tradition was that they always closed Thursday afternoon. So why were the markets open Monday and Thursday? Well, remember, we didn't have the proliferation of production that we had today, so the people needed to gather their goods and offer them here. And you can see the seven markets that were prevalent in those times. It was also a time for reading the Torah. The meeting of the Sanhedrin was an important part. But the prices in the markets were fixed. They couldn't just charge what they wanted to. The prices in the markets were fixed by the officers and by the officials and by the high priest. That was one of the roles. Bankers were licensed, and they charged 8% interest by law. They earned money exchanging the coins in the temple. The average fee to exchange a Roman or an Egyptian coin to a temple coin that was used for the tax was about what we would say 4 cents per coin. Buying a pigeon was 3 cents to offer, which was the lowest offering in the temple. But at Passover, they charged the equivalent of $1.50. So you can see why Jesus was very upset when he came into that temple. The shepherds. You know, sheep herding was a big vocation in Jesus' day. But the shepherds didn't drive the sheep. As you see here, the shepherds led the sheep. And Jesus used those illustrations very often to say, "Those who are my sheep know my voice." And that's exactly what happened. He would whistle the shepherd, and they would recognize the voice. The sheep would do anything, even stop drinking if the shepherd called them. He could mix them with other sheep, and they would always come back to him. The shepherds lived in stone and mud houses. They worked on the rooftops during the day. And the rich had wood to burn. But the importance of the shepherds was the love for their sheep. You know, the education and dress in those days was to study the Torah beginning at the age of 6. They studied it until the age of 10, and then they pressed on. Simple dress, simple education. The food of those days, you know, we think about the food. Food was very simple. They had two regular meals a day, at noon and just after sundown. Vegetables were abounding. Cucumbers, beans, lentils, onions, leeks, vegetables, vegetable marrow, which we would call squash today, and garlic. Besides that, we had things like dates, figs, watermelon, grapes, and of course, the all-important olive. Everyone had at least one olive tree that would yield 10 gallons per tree of oil. They picked in October, but only one picking. The rest was left for the poor. And finally, the Messiah. There was this overwhelming obsession of waiting for the Messiah. Almost everyone agreed that it was from the house of David. In fact, the book of Enoch that was in use in Jesus' day read, "In him dwells the spirit of wisdom and the spirit of enlightenment, the spirit of knowledge and of strength, and the spirit of those who have fallen asleep in justice. He will judge all nations, punishing those who have oppressed the just that is coming. The dead will rise again, heaven and earth will be transformed, and the just will abide with him through life everlasting." They believed that Messiah would bring joy, happiness, holiness, forgiveness, peace. Jerusalem would be made the capital of the world, and that their resurrected loved ones would come back. You know, interestingly, if we find some of those early writings, they believed that they would come back pretty much as they went down into the grave so they could be recognized. Interestingly, isn't it? The problem that they had was how to recognize the Messiah. Thousands came through the house of David at that time. False messiahs, those claiming to be messiahs, were common. The people welcomed them, however, with palms and flowers. The Pharisees questioned them constantly. The people asked for miracles. Prove to us that you're the Messiah. It was no different to them when Jesus came. And the people looked to the high priest for help. Someone claiming to be a Messiah had to go through examination. Too bad that the high priest was corrupt. That's where the people. That's why Jesus never blamed the people. It was the priest that he knew. The actions of those leaders reflected this degradation that Jesus criticized. They strove to prove that there would never be a Messiah. Why? Because they could extend their own power, their own rule. The temple service had made them wealthy. Caiaphas was the 15th high priest in 65 years. He was the last of the house of Annas. He was no longer the high priest for life, remember. But now this was a political appointment. They were deposed quickly, mercilessly, if they were going against Caesar. So their only interest was continuing office, not in truly finding the Messiah. Well, you know, Jesus entered a Jewish world that's really bizarre when we think of our standards today. Yet Daniel, as we said at the beginning, Daniel's prophecy indicated it was the right time for a Messiah to appear. The testimony was given at the proper time. And I think by understanding the context of what was going on in the Jerusalem of that day, Israel of that day, we can put the scholarly, so-called scholarly debate over Jesus and the search people have in perspective. And our own understanding that Jesus lived within this Jewish world, but yet was touched by the many different segments that went on. So as we look at the stories and we look at the Passover accounts, we need to seek the context of the actions, the context of the politics, the context of the difficulties of daily life of those people. Only then can we understand what it was they were facing and what Jesus was offering them compared to what they had. And so it is with that that we can better understand Jesus' words, his actions, prior to the time of our memorial. And I hope as we've taken this tour through life, that early life in Jesus' day, that it will help us as we engage in some of these discussions throughout the rest of the convention in looking at what was going on in those days of Jesus. Amen.